It's 5:06. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. 40 years ago, if a child was born prematurely, its chances of survival were fairly grim. But thanks to scientific and medical advances, government stats show a big improvement.
The Children's Hospital of Wisconsin is home to a Level 4 Neonatal Intensive Care Unit, or NICU. It's a designation reserved for hospitals that handle some of the toughest cases and do so in geographically accessible areas like Milwaukee. The hospital's work was featured recently in Time magazine.
Joining us now to talk about the science, the technology, and the TLC that goes into caring for preemies is Dr. Ganesh Kanduri. He's chief of the hospital's neonatology division at the Children's Hospital of Wisconsin. Dr. Kanduri, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me, Rob.
Well, that article, the Time article we mentioned that featured your hospital, said that the survival rate for premature babies born under 3.3 pounds went from about 28% in 1930 to 78% in 2010. What is making such a big difference in success?
Oh, we have achieved many incredible advances over the last 50 years. And, I think the science of taking care of a newborn baby and technology, and also the team approach that we take in the newborn ICU with everyone geared toward providing the best care for these tiny premature babies has really brought our survival numbers and also the outcomes to where we are now. And at Children's Hospital of Wisconsin last year, for example, more than 90% of the babies that weighed under 3 pounds have survived and gone home. And that's an incredible change in the last 50 years.
Well, let's talk about that team you mentioned. Who is part of this team to help a premature baby?
So we have a specialty that really started in the early 60s called neonatology. This is the art and science of taking care of newborn babies. So we are physicians that undergo further training after completing our training in pediatrics. And we also have a team of dedicated neonatal ICU nursing staff, and we have nurse practitioners. We have a number of support staff members. Those include nutritionists, lactation consultants to encourage the mothers to provide the breast milk for their premature babies while they're growing, and also dedicated pharmacists and other support staff. We work as a team, and we provide round-the-clock consistent care.
And I know a big part of the issue in hospitals in general is making sure when you've got a team like that, whatever the age, from premature to geriatric, is communication. How have you advanced communication between all those players in a success story?
So we make daily rounds as a team, so everyone participates in discussions and developing the plan, and that plan is carried out consistently, around the clock. So if the physicians are handing off to each other, they go around and go through a lot of details. We have electronic medical record that helps tremendously in providing that continuity of care. And the unit has a neonatal specialist 24 hours a day and 7 days a week, and we staff the unit basically to the same depth around the clock. So there are no drop-offs at any shift.
Let's talk about some of the challenges in taking care of the health of a prematurely born baby. Let's start with nutrition, and nutritionists are part of the team. What is the challenge of feeding a premature baby as opposed to a full-term baby?
Premature babies have underdeveloped gastrointestinal tract, so they're not ready to take, feedings into their stomach with milk. So we have to support them for a period of time with intravenous nutrition, and that requires specialized equipment to place these intravenous lines that can be maintained sometimes for weeks or months until they're ready and they're strong enough to take feedings into their stomach. And it also requires special formulations so we can provide all their nutritional needs by providing these intravenous solutions. So we need a lot of support from nutrition and also pharmacy to be able to do that. And over the last 20 years, we tended to actually start even the smallest premature babies on a small amount of feeding, so we can transition them relatively early to feedings, particularly with mom's breast milk. So even when babies are born, 3 to 4 months early. You know, mothers can provide breast milk, and we found through experience that mom's milk will protect the baby from infections and also allows the baby's gastrointestinal system to develop. And so we have made a lot of advances in that area.
And how much more vulnerable are premature babies to infections?
It's a relatively common occurrence because of their small size and underdeveloped immune system, and also the fact that, you know, we put in a lot of tubes to be able to support them, you know, breathing tube to support their, you know, respiratory needs. And we have these intravenous lines to give them nutrition. So that also makes them vulnerable. So the infection rates have ranged anywhere from 5% up to 15%. We have some of the lowest infection rates in the country. And we are certainly doing the job, you know, well in minimizing the possibility of infections. And one of the infections that we worry about is something that we refer to as necrotizing enterocolitis. And it sounds complex and scary, and it is. And it can affect up to 1 out of every 10 prematurely born infants. And so that particular complication can be a major setback to feeding the baby milk. And so we take a lot of care to prevent this complication from occurring in our premature baby. So we graduate the increase in advancing the feeds over time, and we monitor the babies very carefully.
I also wanted to ask about, and this is something that surprised me reading about it, the amount of contact a premature baby needs. In my head, a picture pops up of, I guess, a very isolated state wanting to keep the newborn away from infections. But it turns out, I guess, that some level of contact is a very positive thing for them.
Yes. You know, that was actually traditionally the way that premature babies were taken care of. They were placed inside the incubators, and, you know, parents would watch them through the glass wall of the incubator and were afraid to touch them. And the hospitals felt that this is a good measure to prevent infections. And, you know, we learned through experience that premature babies need the contact of their mother and their father. So we practice something called a kangaroo care. So once the baby's temperature control has been established, usually that takes about, you know, 3 to 7 days after birth, we encourage the parents to come, and they do skin-to-skin care. So they can hold the babies up to an hour, and that actually maintains the baby's temperature and also has a very positive effect on their neurodevelopment. So, and we practice that here at, in our NICU as part of our family-centered care.
And as a parent in that situation, I imagine you might feel reluctant. You want to hold your baby, but they seem so fragile, so vulnerable. Do you work with parents on proper handling techniques for their premature baby?
Yes. Our nursing staff does an incredible job of making the parents feel comfortable. Initially, it's a transition that the parents go through. When they come, they just want to hold a finger. And, you know, they think that the baby is so fragile that if they touch the baby, something is going to go wrong. And, of course, at that point, babies have lots of tubes and wires, you know, connected to them. But we encourage them to, you know, spend time. And over a period of time, the parents feel more and more comfortable. And even with the tubes and wires attached, we can wrap the baby and allow the parents to hold them.
Here's an interesting point from one of our listeners. Melissa, writing on Facebook, wants us to change the conversation on prematurity. She says preventing premature births needs to be a focus. There are stressors and other things that contribute to disparities. I hope, she says, you also discuss prevention. Is that something that your unit works on?
We do. We work with an incredible team of maternal fetal medicine specialists. So these are obstetricians that are specially trained in high-risk pregnancies, and any mom with premature labor is a high-risk pregnancy for us. And so prevention of prematurity is an incredibly important goal, you know, for our physician colleagues. And it directly affects the care that we provide. The listener is correct. There are certainly racial and economic disparities in prematurity rate. And we know, for example, that the African-American population in the city of Milwaukee has prematurity rates that are twice as high as the other ethnic groups. And no one really understands the reason behind the disparity, but Access to prenatal care is one of the important measures to prevent a number of medical conditions in moms that can put them in preterm labor. And these include things like recognizing hypertension and recognizing diabetes. And infections can lead to onset of premature labor. So it's important for moms to have that access to prenatal care from very early on in pregnancy.
We're talking about the medical advancements and other care for babies born prematurely. Our guest is Dr. Ganesh Kanduri. He's chief of the neonatology division at the Children's Hospital of Wisconsin. And we'd like to hear from you. Have you had an experience in a natal intensive care unit? Have you had a premature baby? Were you one yourself? What questions do you have about what goes into caring for babies born prematurely? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org. We're talking with Dr. Ganesh Kanduri. He's chief of the Division of Neonatology at the Children's Hospital of Wisconsin. He's giving us a glimpse of life inside a neonatal intensive care unit and helping us understand how medical advancements have increased the chances of survival for babies born prematurely. And you can join the conversation. What questions do you have about caring for premature babies? Have you been through this yourself as a parent, or do you work in a neonatal intensive care unit? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers now. We've got Jim on the line in Watertown. Jim, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, good afternoon, and thank you for such a great topic. Question for Dr. Kanduri. Just wondering, I heard the comment about access to care being one of the prime contributors to premature infants. And I'm just wondering if you can clarify that maybe. How much of it is actually access to care versus a commitment from the mother-to-be to access care that is available and exists in our city? Thank you.
Jim, thanks for the call. And that follows up on the prevention point we were talking about just a few minutes ago, Dr. Kanduri.
Right. So, access to care is important. And, lack of prenatal care, whether it's lack of availability of the system, or whether the parents are not, or the mother is not motivated to obtain the care. I think, both are equally important. We encourage mothers to, seek medical care from a healthcare provider early in gestation. So the proper nutrition, can be obtained during pregnancy, and also medical conditions that lead to prematurity that I already mentioned, high blood pressure, diabetes, and prenatal infections, they can be recognized early and treated. There are a lot of other things that we can offer. Some moms have recurrence of, prematurity in subsequent pregnancies, and there are medications that are available to lower the odds of having a second or third child born prematurely. And so it's incredibly important for them to, obtain care from her physician.
We'll go back to the phones now. We've got Tom on the line in Madison. Tom, hi.
Good afternoon. Interesting program as usual. I was a three-month early baby back in 1961, and the story that I got was if it wouldn't have been for my weight, which was at 6 months, I was 7 pounds, but they tell me that that was the only thing that kind of pulled me through. But I'm just wondering if you could comment maybe on, additionally to the contact and the contact with the infant, with the baby, how much has changed? I mean, I blew up, for the first 6 months or so quite a bit. And by the time they got an ambulance from the nearest fire station in Madison to the hospital downtown, I would basically come out of it. And it was a story that I heard over and over again about how that they dealt with prematures, that it was basically just incubate them and try to get them as much air as possible and things like that. And the miracles, and I don't even know if miracle is the right word, the science and the skills that are put into premature babies now are just so much different than they were then. It's amazing what the skilled and learned doctors and nurses are able to do. And again, in 1961, it was way different from what it is now, to my understanding. And I can't even imagine what it was like you know, back in the 30s, back in the 40s when some of our parents and grandparents dealt with this. So
Tom,
thank you much, and I'll listen to some comments.
Thanks a lot for the call, and I'm glad you beat the odds. And he really did beat the odds back in 1961, didn't he, Dr. Kondori?
Well, he absolutely did. I think that's an incredible story for us to hear. He certainly beat the odds, and I think all of us remember back in 1963, 50 years ago, President John F. Kennedy had a child in the White House, Patrick Kennedy. He was born actually 6 weeks early, and he weighed a little more than 4 pounds, and he did not survive. He lasted about 2 days and died of complications of respiratory distress. And, you know, since that time, the care of premature babies has received a lot of attention, and there have been incredible advances, you know, that happened with increased funding specifically for research in this area. And there are three things that I can point to. You know, the breathing difficulty that the premature babies face at birth is the most immediate challenge, you know, for their survival. And the listener was correct. You know, back in the 40s and 50s, our premature care essentially consisted of having the baby inside an incubator and flooding the incubator with oxygen. You know, that's all that was done. And some babies survived, and some babies survived with vision loss because the high oxygen concentrations led to loss of vision in premature babies. But since that time, we learned why premature babies have breathing difficulties. It's because of lack of a chemical that lines the inside of the lung called surfactant. And we learned how to make surfactant and give it to babies. If they don't make it on their own, we can put a breathing tube and give it into their lungs. And a second advance came in 1972 when Professor Monty Liggins in Auckland, New Zealand, discovered that when mom is delivering a baby prematurely, giving that mom a medication called betamethasone, it's a steroid, starting about, you know, 24 to 48 hours before the birth of a premature baby, helps to accelerate the maturation of the lung. And that led to a marked decrease in the incidence of respiratory distress in premature babies, and helped babies survive. And then Dr. Gregory at UC San Francisco discovered that applying positive pressure to babies who are struggling to breathe leads to better survival. And that work came out in 1971, and that also led to incredible improvement in the survival of premature babies. So since that time, we have made a lot of additional advances. And I can point to one advance that happened during my career, which is the discovery of inhaled nitric oxide therapy as a treatment option for babies that are struggling to breathe at birth because their blood pressure in the lungs is too high. And we developed the drug in the last 20 years to the point where it's saving thousands of lives. So a lot of things have changed. And so he was incredibly lucky to have survived, you know, back in the early 1960s.
Well, now it seems like the conversation is turning not just to survival, but survival in the best health possible, best brain development. Are we getting closer and closer to a point where survival is very likely, and we're trying to make the best, healthiest grown-up we can when we deal with a premature baby?
Yeah, absolutely. That is the next frontier. So we are at a point where 90% of the babies that are less than 3 pounds at birth are surviving. Now, our next challenge is to ensure that these babies survive with a high quality of life. So they can have a variety of complications that can lead to the neurodevelopmental impairments by the time they grow up into childhood and adult life. So we are making a lot of progress in that direction also. So these babies can develop a number of challenges. They can develop vision loss. And they can develop bleeding complications into their brain, especially our tiny babies that are less than 2 pounds have an increased risk of this complication. And the infections that they're prone to can also affect their development over the long run. But we're making progress in those areas too. So giving a mom betamethasone before the baby is born actually decreases the risk of bleeding complications in their brain, and also helps to mature their gastrointestinal system. So those babies are better able to take in the milk feedings and also grow to a larger size. So,
you mentioned the word frontier a minute ago. Before we let you go, is this an exciting time to be doing your job?
Absolutely. I have done it now for 26 years. And I hope to do it for another 25 years. And so it's an exciting time to be in. And we have advances that are coming up, you know, every year. So just recently, a couple of months ago, there is a group in South Korea that published a very early study putting stem cells into a premature baby's lung to be able to regenerate the lung so we can prevent the a debilitating lung complication that affects the quality of life. It's called chronic lung disease or bronchopulmonary dysplasia. This condition that affects the premature babies makes them dependent on oxygen and medications for years. And
wow.
So using stem cells to recover and regenerate the lungs is an exciting possibility.
It's an exciting time for neonatal care. Thanks to Dr. Yes. Ganesh Kanduri for joining us today. He's chief of the neonatology division at the Children's Hospital of Wisconsin. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, an archaeology project is telling an amazing story of Native American history in Wisconsin, and it's finding the evidence under the lawns of Trempealeau.
First, Wisconsin cheesemakers are expressing serious concerns over a decision made by the Food and Drug Administration this week.
Wooden boards, which have been used by cheese producers around the world in the aging process, were called unsanitary by the FDA after the agency cited several New York operations for using them. Despite state laws that permit the process, the move could spell the end of wooden board aging nationwide.
Here with us to talk about the FDA's decision and what it could mean for Wisconsin is Jeannie Carpenter. She's the director of the Wisconsin Artisan Cheesemaker Guild. Jeannie, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So why is the FDA upset about using wood boards to age cheese?
Well, for the past many, many years, the FDA has left it up to different to the states, really, to enforce cheese aging on woods. And recently in New York State, last week actually, they decided that all of a sudden that wooden boards are no longer sanitary to age cheese on. And not only have they decided this for New York, but for the entire country. And also beyond that, they've now said that no cheese being imported into the United States aged on wooden boards should be allowed either.
Well, give us a little 101 here. Why do cheesemakers use wooden boards? What do they get out of that?
Well, cheese has been aged on wooden boards for, centuries, especially in Europe. Wood is used primarily because it imparts flavor. You know, there's a reason why certain French and Swiss, Italian cheese appellations, like Gruyere, Comté, Parmesan Reggiano, they actually require specific species of wood when aging wheels of cheese. When you don't use wood, the flavor, the texture, even the composition of cheese changes. Even the difference in the air circulation from resting wheels on wood versus plastic or metal can influence a cheese's taste. So cheesemakers had figured this out a long, long time ago. And it's been safe for a long time, and so we're wondering what's changed.
And this is legal under Wisconsin state law. How widespread is it? How much cheese is made with this method?
In Wisconsin, it's estimated between 20 and 30 million pounds of cheese are being aged on wood. And this is from cheesemakers really small, just making a few wheels a year, to bigger cheesemakers making thousands and hundreds of thousands of cheeses a year. Cheesemakers from small to large have figured out that cheese tastes different and some would argue better when aged on wood.
What are you hearing as far as reaction from cheesemakers around the state?
Well, everyone's sort of in this sense of disbelief right now, and it's quickly going from disbelief to high levels of distress. There's cheese factories who have built specific aging facilities underground, to state and FDA regulations where they are aging cheese on wood. And they're really concerned that the time and the investment that they've put into these facilities is going to be lost if the FDA decides that wood or if it enforces that wood is indeed illegal.
You mentioned that plastic and metal might come up with a different taste, a different kind of cheese. Is there an alternative to using the wood that the FDA is apparently banning?
No, they're not stating any sort of alternatives. They're just stating that wooden shelves are they're saying that they're a porous material And so anything that is in a cheese factory or cheese aging facility must be a non-porous material and must be adequately cleaned and sanitized. And the kicker here is that wood boards, no cheesemaker just, you know, nilly-willy ages cheese on boards. These wooden boards are sanitized. They are cleaned. They're often heated in kilns to kill the bacteria. Cheesemakers take this seriously. It's not something that we just discovered. They've been doing it for hundreds of years.
Well, the FDA is taking on more of a prevention role when it comes to food safety instead of reacting to an outbreak. They're trying to stop things like listeria is their main worry here. Is there a case to be made for better safe than sorry? If we've got these porous materials that could harbor listeria, maybe we should look for other ways to do this?
Well, as far as I know, and I've read a lot of studies, I don't know of any cheese that's been recalled specifically because of being aged on wood. That if there's a problem in cheese, it's typically not because of the material it's aged on. It's because something else happened to that milk long before it got placed on that wooden board. So just because there are studies, actually there was a study that came out of the Wisconsin Center for Dairy Research in 2013 where they decided that based on the beneficial effects of wood boards on cheese ripening, that the use of wood boards does not present any sort of danger as long as thorough cleaning procedures is followed. So I think we need to follow that.
So if there are listeria and other foodborne illness outbreaks out there, it's not the cheese?
Well, I mean, it's the cheese, but it's not the wooden board.
Okay. Now, I've seen some reaction pointing to the role of the Food Safety Modernization Act passed a couple years back. Is that part of the story?
I think so, because FDA is taking very much a preventive versus a reactive stance on food safety now under FSMA, as it's lovingly called. Mm-hmm. But I think in this case, their proactive stance is very much misplaced. Science is not on their side in this case. I think they are really interpreting studies incorrectly. And I'm hoping in time that other folks in the FDA will read these same studies and will hopefully clarify the position to going back to letting state departments of agriculture and state safety inspectors like they are now and to enforce the rule.
Well, you mentioned you hope that in time they do that, but is this federal law in effect right now for everyone?
It is. What I'm hearing from state departments of health is that they are still going to, they're not going to be closing down cheese factories, first of all. Nobody wants to lose the economic presence of dairy, especially here in Wisconsin. I think we're kind of in a wait-and-see mode. I know that the FDA is crafting a press release further clarifying their position on this issue. So I think everybody, from consumer to cheesemaker to the folks at state departments of ag are waiting for further clarification from the FDA.
Some of the cheeses aged on these on wood, they're multi-year processes, aren't they?
They are. I mean, some of the most famous cheeses in America are aged on wood. We have here in Wisconsin, Pleasant Ridge Reserve from Uplands Cheese. It's a triple Best in Show winner from the American Cheese Society. It's been aged on wooden boards from its beginning. Likewise, for current U.S. champion cheese, Marika Gouda from Thorpe. And then cheeses, in Vermont, Cabot Classbound. Basically name a famous cheese from America that's won major awards, and it's been aged on wood.
But I wonder, since it can take years to age some of these cheeses, is that making it difficult for cheesemakers to plan? Should I start a new batch now that might be a 1 or 3 or 5 year process, knowing that maybe I'll have to stop midway through?
That's a really good question. I suppose a lot of cheesemakers are wondering that. But the other thing I'm hearing from cheesemakers is that they have been very compliant with everything else that FDA has handed down to them through FSMA. They've been very compliant with increased regulation, increased inspection, increased critical control safety point plans. But I think a lot of them are going to say enough's enough with this decision, and I think the FDA is going to have a fight on their hands.
I know it's early in the reaction stage, but are cheesemakers, maybe even state officials, planning to pick up that fight?
I hope so. There's a lot of talk amongst the industry of trade organizations partnering with cheesemakers and even consumers. There's already been a petition filed with the White House to retract this clarification from the FDA. So this is interesting because this seems to be an issue that is binding consumers, the organizations, cheesemakers, and even politicians together. It's one of those issues that everybody loves their cheese and nobody wants it to go away.
Jeannie, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That was Jeannie Carpenter. She's director of the Wisconsin Artisan Cheesemaker Guild. And we've had a lot of response to this issue on Facebook already at the Central Time Facebook page.
That's right. Jennifer has said, remarkably bad decision, one that could be particularly damaging for Wisconsin's economy.
And Beldar writes, good Lord, our cheese already loses the taste test when compared with cheese from the UK. The FDA isn't going to let up till we're all sitting around discussing the finer qualities of Velveeta over a glass of Morgan David. Well, thanks for those Facebook comments. And you can head over to the Central Time Facebook page and share your thoughts as well. When we think of archaeology, we may think of remote explorations and digging in out-of-the-way deserts and jungles around the world.
But an ongoing project here in Wisconsin has made some surprising discoveries under people's lawns in Trempealeau. Danielle Benden is with the Trempealeau Archaeology Project. She's senior academic curator for the UW-Madison Department of Anthropology. Danielle, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So what have you and your team found so far in Trempealeau?
Well, we have been up just for a couple of days. This is our second day of the 2014 summer season. We've been working in the area for the last, I've been working in the area for the last 15 years and more intensively in the last 4 years or so. And what we've uncovered is looks to be a colony of people that archaeologists call Mississippians who came up from the site of Cahokia, which is near St. Louis, Missouri, about 1,000 years ago, and settled right here in Wisconsin.
So that's quite a journey from the St. Louis area, Cahokia, to up near Trempealeau. How did they get there?
So we think they presumably came via dugout canoe up the Mississippi River, and I stress the word up the Mississippi River.
Right, because it's against the current.
Yeah, there's a lot of people that go down the Mississippi River, but there's not very many people who would make a 700 river mile journey up the river, crossing several sets of rapids, and it's a really long journey. They really wanted to get to Trempealeau.
And do we know the why? I guess that's the big question when you look at a journey like that.
Yes, these are the kinds of questions we're asking. Why did they leave? Why did they leave Cahokia? Why did they come to Trempealeau? It looks like they didn't really stop anywhere in between. Of course, they had to stop to camp, from time to time. But it doesn't look like they stopped and set up shop anywhere else in between. So what we have is, it looks almost like a moonshot. They leave Cahokia. We think that they knew that they were headed to Trempealeau, and the question is why. Well, we have been trying to answer those questions in the last few years working here, and we're continuing to do some excavation to uncover the answers. We think it has actually something to do with the geology of the area. So if your listeners or you have been to the Trempealeau area, it's very unique geologically. We're in the unglaciated driftless area of Wisconsin in the upper Mississippi River Valley, just along the Mississippi River. And Trempealeau is famous for Trempealeau Mountain, which is a spit of land that is completely surrounded by water. And actually, the word Trempealeau is a French word, and if you translate it loosely, it means Trempealeau Mountain is La Montagne qui Trempealeau, which is the mountain whose foot is bathed in water or surrounded completely by water. And that's unique because in the entire 2,400-mile stretch of the Mississippi River, it is the only place where you get a remnant bluff sitting surrounded completely by water. So undoubtedly it was a landmark going back since the first people arrived in Wisconsin 12 or 13,000 years ago. And presumably Mississippian people who came from Cahokia knew about it 1,000 years ago when they left Cahokia and came to set up a colony here in Trempealeau.
Oh, and so what have you found so far, and where are you digging?
A lot of, I was listening to the opening, and you're exactly right. When a lot of people think of archaeology sites, they think of faraway, distant places, and what we're literally digging in people's backyards, because the modern village of Trempealeau is situated over a 1,000-year-old village set up by Cahokians. And so you know, we have yet to draw a line around the extent of the site, because every time we do work in somebody's yard and put a shovel in the ground, we're finding more and more things. So we find things like the remnants and sometimes almost complete parts of pottery vessels that these people make, and they make a very distinctive kind of pottery that is painted red with really beautiful decorations. We find their stone tools. We find their houses. So they build very distinctive houses that are different than the local people would have been building. They make these rectangular-shaped well trench structures, are what they're called. So they're kind of semi-subterranean, which is great, keeps you warmer in the winter and cooler in the summer. And so, you know, we're basically, what we see is it looks like they literally brought everything with them. There is clay in the hills around here to make pots. There's stone, there's tool to make stone, stone material to make stone tools. But they're not really using the local material. They're bringing everything with them. And so when you look at the literature of colonization and colonies, you know, when Europeans come to the New World, what do? They bring everything with them because they want to make sure that they have the stuff that is part of their cultural, you know, heritage and their cultural, upbringing.
Well, it also sounds like they intended to stay for a while. How long were they there?
Well, you know, this is an interesting question. So far, they're here for a very short period of time. It looks to be just about 50 years or so, and then they're gone. And that's another question is why? Why did they come and set up a shop here and then leave 50 years later? And we don't know the answer to that question yet, but we do know that we think that it's a pretty elite group of people who traveled up the river and settled here. And we know that because at Cahokia and nearby sites, when you find this kind, very distinctive kinds of pottery that we're finding in our excavations in Trempealeau, it's associated with really elite residences. So just like any big city, which, you know, Cahokia was a city, it was, you know, roughly 20,000 people living there about 1,000 years ago, you have various socioeconomic statuses within the group of people, right? So you have those that are wealthier than others and those that are a little bit poor. And you see in the poorer residences, not everybody has access to the nicer, it's sort of like fine china, right? So not everybody has access to the nicer kinds of things. And what we're finding up here in Trempealeau is pretty much almost all of this really the nicer made stuff that archaeologists call fineware. And so we think it's a small group of elites that are leaving Cahokia and coming up and setting up shop in Trempealeau. I think that it's a relatively small group of people, and we can kind of tell that judging by how many people would live in a house and based on the number of houses we found. Something also really important is that Mississippian people build flat rectangular mounds, and they're all made of basket loads of dirt. So at Cahokia, the largest of these flat-top mounds is called Monk's Mound, and it's 100 feet tall, and it's 15 acres at the base. So
Wow. For
your listeners who are familiar, they've been to a football game at Camp Randall, that would fill Camp Randall, and it's all made of dirt. We have three platform mounds, and actually we're working, there's a fourth one in the village of Trempealeau. So there's four platform mounds in Trempealeau. They're not nearly that size. They're much smaller, but they're bringing everything with them, even this idea of building their platform mounds.
Now, it sounds as though the locals in Trempealeau are getting involved. It's just not archaeology students and scientists. How are the residents of Trempealeau getting involved in all this?
Yeah, they absolutely are. So this project that I'm doing is sponsored by the Baldwin Wisconsin Ideas Endowment and also by the Mortgage Center for Public Service at UW-Madison. And, you know, it's essentially this idea of advancing the Wisconsin idea where, you know, the boundaries of the university are the boundaries of the state. It's how can we as members of UW-Madison and not just faculty and staff but students go out into communities across the state and across the country and the world for that matter and provide our expertise and help out the local, communities and engage them and work collaboratively. And so this project does just that. So we've got the excavations, and I've got 12 UW-Madison students with me now, and they're taking up my archaeology field methods course. And we also will have members of the public come and excavate with us. And that is just so much fun, not only for our students and the residents to get to know each other, but also just it really provides a sense of ownership for the local community to be able to uncover something that is 1,000 years old. It's been 1,000 years since anybody's touched that. That's really incredible sensation for us as archaeologists, but also for the members of the community. It's literally in their backyard. So that's sort of one way we're engaging them. And then the second way we'll engage them is through the rest of the next 2 years when I teach a curation methods course at Madison. And that's what do we do with everything once it's been excavated? How do we care for it? How do we manage it? How do we use it for interpretation?
And so, we're going to have to leave it there. We're out of time. But Danielle, thank you so much for joining us. It's fascinating.
Thank you so much.
We've been speaking with Danielle Benden, Senior Academic Curator for the UW-Madison Department of Anthropology, talking about the ongoing Trempealeau Archaeology Project.